Chapter 21. Draco stands by his windowsill and looks out onto the perfectly manicured gardens of Malfoy Manor. It seems to him that if he only looks close enough, he'll be able to see the pattern of his magic, which had made its way through the greenery, encouraging it to grow. In the window between the two panes lays a dead fruit fly, bleached white by the sun. Draco considers banishing it, but in the end, leaves it where it is. There's something strangely captivating about the white carcass, the after-effects of life, frozen and preserved. Evidence of Draco's shoddy cleaning job, he thinks with amusement. Grand displays of magic, it would seem, do not guarantee detailed execution. This time, when he looks out onto the garden he'd created, Draco can see unevenness in his work there too. The irregularities in the pathways, the stray branches, the creeping vines. Yet, it is in those very mistakes, it seems to him, that nature makes itself known, as though too much perfection would have rendered the whole thing artificial. He wonders if this is why his feelings for Harry are so complex, because they are imperfect. Because they too have leftover weeds and fruit flies which had entered in through imperceptible cracks, only to get trapped and forgotten there. And in any case, could or even should one strive for perfection? And was that search for perfection not simply an excuse? A way to say, "I do not want it at all," without admitting that this was what you were truly saying. A gong sounds through the manor, and in the distance, just beyond the gate, Draco sees Blaze pop into existence. He stands there for a long moment, looking up at the manor. Draco can't help wonder what he's thinking, how it must feel to him, being back here in England, standing on British soil. And at that moment, as though hearing Draco's thoughts, Blaze first crouches, then kneels, then bends in half, letting his forehead touch the earth. Blaze never believed he'd be able to return to England, Draco realizes. Shuddering at the thought, he turns away. A man should be allowed to reconvene with his land without the witness of others. "Do you feel safe appearing in public?" Draco asks as he stands, leaning in the doorway of what's to be Blaze's room. The man is unpacking his things. Books are flying onto bookshelves, which grow out of the wall to accommodate them. Robes of every color shake themselves out and wrap around hangers that are stretching to the exact width of Blaze's shoulders. Toiletries dance around the sink countertop in the ensuite bathroom. "No," Blaze replies, "but there's no point putting it off." "Why?" "I was thinking we could grab breakfast before we head in to see Warbeck. It'll be less, I don't know. I feel like if the two of us just stride into the Ministry of Magic, we'd cause a bit of an uproar. Better to be seen first." Blaze laughs, shakes his head. "How will breakfast prepare them for our arrival?" he asks. "There's a little coffee shop," Draco replies. "Kim Clark's, beside the ministry, which their officials frequent. By the time we finish breakfast, the ministry will be well and truly aware of our existence." "My existence." "Well," says Draco, "yes." Blaze turns to look at Draco, and in his eyes, Draco can see the words he can't quite bring himself to say. "We can still back down." They watch each other this way for a long moment. Draco considers it. Then he thinks about Blaze, only half an hour ago, on his knees in Draco's gateway. How many others are there out there like him, cut off from their homes? "The only people who never fall," says Draco finally, "are those afraid of flight." "I see you've been reading the divination section of the Prophet," says Blaze with a grin. And Draco can't help himself. He crosses the room and places a hand on Blaze's shoulder. "Welcome home, my brother," he says, and for some incomprehensible reason, his voice cracks. Blaze stares at him. Then his features twist, crumble. He pulls Draco close and buries his face in his shoulder. He shakes in Draco's arms, and it's so familiar that Draco has to close his eyes in an attempt to stave off his own emotions. "Is it?" Is this home when this is all that's left? When we're all that's left? Blaze. Everything we know, everyone we loved, gone. Our parents, Merlin, our grandparents, they started a war, and we're the ones paying for it. All of us. Who in our year has been spared, even among them? The Hufflepuffs and Ravenclaws, the Gryffindors. Potter and Longbottom lost their parents. I, Red Granger, obliviated hers. Weasley's brother may as well have been executed. We're all paying for it, and it was what? What was it for? What did we gain? Nothing. The answer is always nothing. People think they sacrifice for future generations, but really, what they're sacrificing are the future generations. It seems in that moment that Blaze is crying for all of them, for every injury, every loss. And then Draco is crying too, because even he can't remain stoic in the face of such overwhelming grief. They weren't great, Blaze says, voice breaking. You know they weren't great. But I was supposed to grow up. I was supposed to grow up and be just like them. They were supposed to finally see me, learn to respect me, grow to regret the years they lost getting to know me because they put the stupid ministry first. And now I'll never get to prove. I was supposed to get the chance to prove. I'm sorry you lost them, breathes Draco. I'm sorry you lost. Draco doesn't know how to say, I'm sorry you lost your family. They stay that way for a long while, then they part, and Blaze looks, for all intents and purposes, like nothing has happened, like he's always been happy, and the tears were nothing more than Draco's imagination playing tricks on him. They get a surprising amount of stares when they enter Kim Clark's. It's a quaint little coffee shop owned by Clark Davis, a flamboyant and shockingly handsome young gay man, and Kim Lee, a petite Asian woman in her late 50s. They met a few years after the war ended, due to a shared wall between their two apartments, which, for whatever reason, wouldn't take any spell work. This resulted in the neighbors being privy to each other's entire lives. Kim had told Draco, one quiet, rainy afternoon, that she had overheard Clark on a fire call with his parents. They told him they'd lost everything in a bad investment, and therefore would no longer be paying his bills. Kim, who recently inherited a dusty little commercial space and been about to sell it, reached out to her buyer, told him she'd changed her mind, and promptly knocked on Clark's door. She informed him that they would be opening a coffee shop together, and if he didn't agree to the venture, he'd be a horrible person, leaving a little old lady all alone to deal with vendors and be taken advantage of. Not that anyone who spent more than 5 minutes in Kim's company could ever imagine someone getting one over on her. Patrons avoid eye contact as Blaze and Draco move to one of the available tables. An older woman loudly drags her chair to the opposite end of her table in an attempt to get away. Draco frowns. He's here regularly enough that he's rarely given even a second glance. Looking around, he notices the waitresses whispering amongst themselves and sending the two of them suspicious glances. Eventually, one of them is pushed forward. She takes a pair of menus and heads to their table. "Here you go, Draco," she says, without meeting his eyes. "Is it always like this?" asks Blaze, face impassive as he scans his menu. "I suppose, with your hair, it's rather obvious that you're a Malfoy." Draco hums. "It's not me, it's you." Blaze turns in his seat, raising a finger to call back their waitress, who'd scurried away the moment she laid down their menus. "No," says Blaze, "it's definitely you. No one's even looking at me." She returns to them, tapping her pad with her quill in a nervous staccato. "What can I get you, gentlemen?" "Eggs Benedict, please," says Draco, "and a black coffee." "Same," says Blaze with a nod. Their waitress licks her lips, shuffles from one foot to another, then blurts, "Maybe you should just get the coffees, to go." Draco can feel his eyebrows rising into his hairline. "That would be lovely," says Blaze, laying his hand down on Draco's as he opens his mouth in protest. At Blaze's sharp look, Draco scowls but remains silent, giving the girl a nod. She comes back a moment later with two coffees in to-go mugs and a copy of the Daily Prophet. "I didn't ask for that," says Draco, nodding at the newspaper. "Yes, you did," she replies, handing him the paper and his cup. "Coffee's on the house, gentlemen. Have a good day." Draco stares at her in amazement, but Blaze is already getting out of his chair with a warm "thank you" and heading to the door. "What the fuck?" snaps Draco once they're outside. Blaze takes the Daily Prophet from him and opens it up. He looks at the front page and blanches. "Shit," he says, "you're all over the front page." "What?" Blaze purses his lips, then begins to read. "Mr. Malfoy, Voldemort's favorite protege, has been caught in meetings with numerous high-profile Death Eaters and their associates. After a long and thorough investigation, it has become clear to this author that Slytherins and Slytherin sympathizers alike are trying to regroup and crawl, not only into the public's good graces, but back into power." He looks up at Draco, who has to set his coffee down for fear of spilling it. "It gets worse," he says, but Draco clenches his teeth and nods at the paper, so Blaze goes on. "Draco Malfoy definitely plans to run for Minister of Magic," an anonymous source close to this author claims. "And then, well, you know what Malfoys are," meaning Death Eaters, "he'll force everyone to turn dark. Our kids will be learning to cast unforgivables in their first year." Malfoy would have us believe that he is nothing more than a businessman nowadays, and that his status as a Death Eater is all in the past. However, the public remembers well the part he personally played in the war, including the storming of Hogwarts. Merlin, they're trying to eviscerate him. Why is this happening? The image of Ron holding Draco's copy of the rattle flashes through his mind. "It's true," says Hedora Weasley. "My team and I have been working tirelessly to get Malfoy and his cohorts off the streets." "Merlin, it sounds like you're in some sort of gang." "But it's not so simple." The Malfoys are powerful and tricky. Even Harry, referring to Harry Potter, savior of the wizarding world, has started to believe in Malfoy's innocence. "All I can say is, until my investigation is concluded, the public would be safer keeping away from Mr. Malfoy." Though the Ministry has numerous tracking charms on Slytherins and their wands, we all know that dark wizards can cast Imperio non-verbally, meaning that everyone who comes into contact with Mr. Malfoy is potentially at risk. If Draco had any doubt that Weasley was behind the article, it's gone. This whole thing is a personal attack. Ron not only saw the article in the rattle and understood it, but he'd found a way to counteract Draco's plan without even breaking a sweat. What chance does he have now, after this, to get anyone in the wizarding world on his side? While this author has been unable to determine what exactly has been discussed at these Death Eater meetings, one thing is clear. The danger has not passed. So long as dark wizards walk among us, we are all at risk. Draco takes the paper from Blaze. He feels faint. Blood rushes in his ears. His mouth is dry. He tries to take in the article, but he can't focus on the words. All he can do is stare at the photo of himself being led out of his office by Weasley in handcuffs. He looks so guilty. The photograph takes up half the page. Draco can't help but note the fear in his eyes in the photograph, and that fear seems to seep off the page and into his skin. He'd lived in peace for so long, and now. Draco's breath catches. There, below the photo, in small print, it says, "If you or your loved ones have come into contact with Mr. Malfoy and are feeling off, please stop by St. Mungo's for your free dark magic checkup, courtesy of the Department of Magical Law Enforcement." "He's trying to destroy me," says Draco. "He wants to make sure that no matter the outcome of the investigation, I'm never welcome in polite society again." Blaze shrugs a shoulder. "He's a chess player." "What?" Weasley, he's a chess player, don't you remember? He won the Interhouse tournament every year. The what? Asks Draco. You never did see things outside your direct line of vision, did you? Says Blaze, his fond smile softening the bite of his words. Stop acting so calm, snaps Draco, shaking the paper in Blaze's face. Like this is nothing. Like it doesn't mean anything. It doesn't, Blaze replies. This is how politics work. One side smears the other. You didn't think it would be easy, did you? No, I just... But he did. Somehow, beneath it all, Draco had assumed that the whole thing would be effortless. That the only reason people weren't communicating was that no one had tried to make them, and all he had to do was walk into the Wizengamot and say, "We want to make peace," and peace would miraculously happen. Come on, says Blaze. Matilda is expecting us in 15 minutes. No, Draco replies. I can't. After this? How do I face her after this? Is anything in this article true? What? Says Draco, aghast. No, of course not. Then you can face her. Let's go.